This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As with all presidents, the incoming Trump administration will face many foreign policy challenges. Some are known right now. Others will crop up unexpectedly. Among the most complex ongoing challenges, of course, is the Middle East. The fight against ISIS may change, but it will continue. Israeli-Palestinian tensions will also continue, and the conflict in Syria is likely to remain a crisis, at least for a while. And there are other foreign policy decisions to be made about China and Russia, to name just two. But where there are challenges, there are also opportunities. And President-elect Trump has promised a new approach. Could this fresh approach work? For answers to that question and many more, we turn to two foreign policy experts, Ambassador Thomas Pickering and Dr. Jim Walsh. Both are in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. They will speak today at noon at lunch, and there are still seats available for that lunch. You can go to worldaffairscharlotte.org for information about how to register. Ambassador Pickering is a former seven-time ambassador to countries all over the world from the United States, including Russia, India, Israel, Jordan, El Salvador, and the United Nations, where he was named career ambassador. He currently co-chairs the International Crisis Group and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Charlotte and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Dr. Walsh is a senior research associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Security Studies Program. His research and writings focus on international security and, in particular, topics involving nuclear weapons, the Middle East, and East Asia. His commentary and analysis, by the way, has been used by all of the major news outlets, and he is the international security contributor to NPR's Here and Now. You've probably heard him on the station before. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you so much. It's thrilling to be here.
Let us start with Iran. President-elect Trump and other Republicans have called the Iran nuclear agreement a very bad deal. And during the campaign, Trump repeatedly called what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action for being insufficiently tough and threatened to walk away from the agreement if elected. Is the Iran nuclear deal a bad deal?
I don't think so. I think that we will probably differ. It's not a perfect deal, in the sense that there are things like time limits that a number of us would like to see changed. But it is a deal which shuts down Iran's possibilities of producing a nuclear weapon through a breakout strategy in probably something over a year. And that gives time for the international community to react and to work. And the international community on the Iran deal has been united. So absent the Iran deal, tearing it up would put us in a position where Iran would be free, literally, to do whatever it wishes with its nuclear program, with the only binding commitment it has made not to make a nuclear weapon. And, of course, there's been distrust about that. Were it to be torn up, perhaps another strategy might be pursued by Iran to keep the deal with the other countries who have made it, because we haven't made this deal alone, and try to isolate the United States, something we did successfully with Iran in the period leading up to the deal, which I think added some impetus to the negotiations and the effort to get a deal. I think, finally, we have an opportunity to improve the deal, and I would hope that President Trump would think about that. A better deal is not tearing up the old deal and starting fresh. A better deal is taking the old deal and adding to it perhaps new dates, adding to it new obligations, adding to it perhaps the fact that others who we're concerned about might join Iran in limiting its enrichment.
They came to the table and made this deal because there were serious economic sanctions for years on Iran, which I guess some of which have been removed. What guarantees are in place that they will follow the deal, and what incentives could there be to make them improve the deal from our point of view?
Well, I think certainly economic sanctions was one part of that story. There are other parts of that story as well, the drop in the price of oil, the changing internal politics in Iran. President Rouhani campaigned on trying to resolve the nuclear issue. He won that election. Others who were running against him did not endorse that platform. So I think there were a constellation of variables involved. I think, you know, one thing to keep in mind is we've actually had the deal now, a deal in place, for 3 years. We had an interim deal for 2 years. Now we have a full year under our belt. And every month, the International Atomic Energy Agency reports to the world community and says Iran is abiding by that deal. And when you read commentary in Tehran, what you hear Iranian officials saying is they don't want the deal torn up. They want to keep going with it. So I think those are all good signs. But I understand that people have objections to the deal. Let me just say, sometimes because something isn't perfect, we don't fully appreciate it. How do we judge a deal? We compare it to other deals. This is not our first rodeo. We've had all sorts of arms control agreements through the 70 years of the nuclear age. In my professional judgment, this is the strongest non-proliferation agreement ever negotiated. It is the obligations on Iran in inspection are unprecedented. No country on the globe submits to the kind of inspection that Iran does right now.
So what are the objections to this deal? If it's such a strong deal, the best we've ever made, Jim Walsh, as
yes.
you just said, what are the objections to it? And why have the objections seemed to hit the headlines and stick?
Sure. Let me go back to that. I think President Trump has been very nonspecific about his objections, but Jim and I have followed the objections.
But he's not alone. A lot of Republicans.
No, a lot of people have joined. Some of it is because it was Obama's deal. Some of it is because it isn't a perfect deal, that it doesn't extend forever. Some of it is because after many years of trying, both in the Bush and Obama administration, zero enrichment was not achievable. The Iranians insisted that they had a right to enrich, and there is some enrichment permitted, but under very strict inspection and under very, very tight limitations in a way that makes that, I think, as safe and as secure as we can make it. And the difference between zero enrichment and the permitted enrichment that goes on now is not constitute the kind of danger that we were concerned about when Iran was enriching without any fetters. So I think those are the concerns, those are the complaints about the deal that have come from Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel and otherwise. But it's fascinating. In Israel, where I went twice before the deal was consummated, over 200 national security experts and former IDF Israeli Defense Force leaders and generals have endorsed the deal as something useful and something valuable, contrary to Mr. Netanyahu's experience. And have you heard from Mr. Netanyahu recently about the deal? That sort of died away. So my sense is there is a challenge not to tear up the deal, but an opportunity to improve it over the next 3 to 5 to 8 years. And so it's time to get going. And there's something here that Mr. Trump could actually do that would redound to his advantage in meeting the challenges of the limitations on the deal, and he has time to do it. And he would, I believe, have support for doing it from the other negotiators on our side, particularly if he didn't tear it up. If he tore it up, we'd be the first in violation of the deal. And you have to know that when the deal was under consideration in the Senate, a number of ambassadors from the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, the 4 others, went down and testified before the Senate that if we tore up the deal, they would not support us with the additional sanctions that I think would be necessary to try to achieve a better deal. And after trying it for years, neither Bush nor Obama was able to make that work. So, in fact, we're trying to point the direction toward a better deal and the direction toward an opportunity and the direction toward not meeting the challenge by a new challenge, but meeting the challenge by something that looks like it could be a win-win.
So those other countries that we're talking about circuitously are China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and Germany.
Yes.
And they've all see benefits to this, and they've all said, we will not support any sanctions that you put on this if we pull out, if we, the United States, pulls out. Opponents have said that we did not use all of the sanctions at our disposal to negotiate a better deal. If there were a better deal, what would it be?
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask that question. I think Tom has rightly said that if there's something you want more of, it would be an extension on some of the limits. Some of the limits in the agreement are in perpetuity. The additional protocol, that's on Iran forever. The fact that they had to destroy the Arak reactor, this plutonium reactor, that's forever. Their NPT, non-proliferation treaty obligations, are forever. But other obligations begin to come off the books sometime around the 15-year period. Mm-hmm. Now, 15 years, it's like dog years. 15 years in the Middle East, is, you know, a long, long, long time. But still, you know, it would be great if we can find a way, maybe on the principle of more for more, where all the parties give more and they all get more, to continue to extend that. Or, as Tom will probably want to discuss himself, the notion that we take some of these, as I said, I think this is the most robust agreement of its kind ever negotiated. Maybe we should start to extend that, make that the new gold standard for all the nations of the world in terms of their nonproliferation obligations, and we make it more universal. And I think that would be a positive step.
So you're the longtime ambassador, Mr. Ambassador. take the deal off, leave the deal in place, but let's talk about what this could mean long term for the United States if it stays in place. Because for the longest time, since the Carter administration, we had no relationship with Iran whatsoever. Now we do. What could this mean diplomatically over time?
Over time, I think this could mean diplomatically both a challenge and a new opportunity. The challenge would be how and in what way does the new administration see the greater Middle East, and particularly at the moment now, the conflicts that in your introduction I think you wisely referred to and which are deeply challenging. So let's begin by saying there's a difference between Iran and potentially and really, I suppose, Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, between whether a Persian-run Middle East or an Arab-run Middle East, or a Shia-run Middle East, or a Sunni-run Middle East.
Do you think most Americans understand the distinctions?
I don't think so. I think that there are differences in history and differences in prayer methods, and there are differences between Arabs and Persians in language.
Can you say
that? That have to be there, and that obviously they are part of the ethic of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But the notion that there should be a hegemon in the Middle East in itself is probably a notion that comes naturally to the people in Tehran and in Riyadh, but isn't necessarily something that God has ordered that must be the set of circumstances. One could actually see the cooperation between the two and win-win possibilities. After all, Saudi Arabia and Iran both agree on the price of oil. After all, they could cooperate as Muslims without emphasizing the Shia-Sunni differences over the unity of the Islamic world as a religion. After all, salam in Arabic means peace, as a religion of peace and cooperation. They could organize themselves against the Sunni radicals in Daesh, in ISIS, in ISIL, who they both oppose, all the same thing, that would provide them a new way to proceed. And one could look for perhaps a settlement in Yemen as being an early indication. And this has been worked on. It's not there yet. But Saudi intervention in Yemen, I think, produced Iranian intervention in Yemen rather than the other way around. But Yemen is a battle between Shia and Sunni in Yemen. It is something that should be, and I hope can be, an early indication that maybe we could change the theory of the case and not be in a position of thinking that we appoint or somehow establish hegemons, but that we work for a more peaceful and a more cooperative region. Now, people will tell you Shia and Sunni have never gotten along. The truth is they have. And in many centuries, you will see Shia and Sunni marrying each other, just as one example.
And we had that in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power. Ambassador Thomas Pickering with us and Dr. Jim Walsh from MIT. We're coming right back and talking about ISIS. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Chesterbrook Academy, dedicated to preparing children academically, socially, and emotionally for elementary school, hosting an open house on Saturday. Details at chesterbrookacademy.com. And Bojangles, featuring the Gravy Biscuit, an open-faced, made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit topped with gravy, available all day at area Bojangles. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was not just a civil rights leader, he was a Baptist minister, and he used his religious understanding underpinnings to prick America's conscience. Today's clergy has begun to pick up the torch to address racial inequality and end to racism and police brutality, among other things. It's beginning to look like a trip back to the 60s in some areas, but will the outcome be as impactful? Religion's role in addressing social justice. The topic tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, the confirmation hearings for Trump's controversial Secretary of Education nominee, Betsy DeVos. We'll unpack the tough questions for the school vouchers advocate. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio with Ambassador Thomas Pickering, seven-time ambassador from the United States to places like Israel, Jordan, Russia, India, the United Nations, also a member of the International Crisis Group and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Jim Walsh is also here, senior research associate at MIT and Here and Now's security contributor. Let's talk about ISIS, because there's a lot of talk about ISIS during this presidential campaign, and the president calls it ISIL. It's the same thing. But given that ISIS is not a nation state, is it a foreign policy problem per se?
I think it's definitely a foreign policy problem. It poses risks certainly to our allies in the region. It has the effect of destabilizing the region. It invaded Iraq. You know, we were slowly pushing them out of Iraq, but Iraqis don't have control over their own territory, over their own country, and we want Iraq to succeed as a stable country with territorial integrity. I think there's also the possibility, and this is how complicated things are in the Middle East, that as they face more defeats on the battleground, become less sort of this hybrid non-state actor slash government and more towards a terrorist group, that they could change strategy and begin to conduct terror attacks. I think that's further in the distance, but I think, yes, it's absolutely from a counterterrorism or from an alliance standpoint a real concern.
Are they the global threat that they are painted out?
Maybe I could talk about that, because I think what we have seen with ISIS under pressure now for a year, they lost Fallujah, they lost other pieces of their territory, particularly to the Kurds. ISIS has been following an al-Qaeda-like strategy. They've been doing two things. They've been increasingly franchising all around the Islamic world organizations that cleave to fundamentalist ideas on the one hand and to radical retribution, if I could call it that, on the other. And secondly, they have then been using their surrogates and their affiliates, their franchisees, their Kentucky Fried Chicken stations, to attack people, particularly in Europe, but in the United States. I think San Bernardino perhaps represented one. Perhaps the major in Texas represented another. And so they're trying to bring home the battle to the homeland of the unbelievers that they very much object to. They represent a small but powerful minority. We have been deeply concerned by the fact that they established a territorial place for themselves in northern Iraq and northern Syria and claimed that they were reestablishing the caliphate, something that traditionally in Islam was used to unite all Muslims. The Turkish Sultan for many years in the Ottoman days was the caliph. This has been a powerful voice, but not nearly as powerful as I think some of us imagined it might be in bringing flocks of Muslims into a radical Islamic posture. And we're lucky for that. But we need to be careful not to believe that the end of ISIS in its territorial position will end it with respect to its franchises and its ability to use its surrogates and minions to attack us in other places. And so intelligence and sharp police work are, in my view, as much the front edge of the attack as major military forces in Iraq and Syria.
President-elect Trump has said he intends to declare war on ISIS using very few troops because we have to wipe them out. That's his justification. Can we wipe them out? And if we do, won't they simply be replaced by some other terrorist organization or sect, Dr. Jim Walsh?
Well, if you look back at the history of counterterrorism, there are instances in which groups have been eradicated or have given up the fight. Mm-hmm. So there's been some wins. And that comes in different forms. Sometimes it's a settlement. In the case of Al-Qaeda Central, it was really degrading it through drones and other sorts of operations. But I think, you know, I think it's a great campaign thing to say you're going to declare war on someone. I've yet to hear what the actual plan is. You know, you need a strategy. You need to have a sense of what it's going to cost, what your probability of success is, what are the possible unintended consequences, who you're going to work with. And what does a success look like? I haven't seen any of this.
When you hear a candidate say, as Mr. Trump did say many times, that he knows more about ISIS than the generals, what goes through your mind as somebody who's an expert not only on foreign policy but on terrorism itself?
Well, I'm shaken up. Yeah. I truly am, because I think the generals and our chief diplomats in the field and our intelligence community know a great deal. And he has, in a sense, if you can say this, popularized himself on the basis of denigrating those individuals. But they have spent years learning it, learning the language, understanding the networks, collecting secret intelligence, which has been very valuable in dealing with it, and putting together the strategy. My sense is the strategy needs to involve three clear elements. One is what we're undertaking with the Iraqis and with the Syrian opposition, to remove the caliphate. And that has priority, and it's important. But secondly, we need to be aware that we need to track the franchises. We need to work very closely with the local governments where they take place. We need to isolate the individuals who are involved and roll them up as they begin to operate those franchises against the local Muslim and non-Muslim communities. And finally, we need to penetrate the organizations that have come into our country and have come into Europe and have come into other places to wreak damage. Mm-hmm. And we are making some progress in that. But Europe has had weak intelligence resources aligned against this. I think we have done, knock on wood here in the studio, better. But we have to watch that very, very carefully, because that's what I would call the left hook of ISIS, the one we don't see coming so often, and the one that wreaks damage closest to home, and so its propaganda and influence value is stronger. And I don't somehow see Mr. Trump, with all that wisdom, thinking about those new two manifestations of ISIS that I pointed out to you.
Terrorism and the threat of terrorism has become a great political tool, not unlike a sledgehammer, because people are afraid and they want to feel safe in their own home and in their own movie theater, in their own shopping mall, wherever it may be. And you have said, Dr. Walsh, you wrote an article about this, that a lot of what we think we know about terrorism simply is not true. There was an article you wrote headlined, "Your Beliefs About Terrorism and Islam Are a Hot Mess of Myth and Illogic." And you were talking not just to ordinary people, but to politicians as well. So bust some myths for us.
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is, what is it that terrorism as a method is trying to accomplish? It's trying to get in our heads and make us fearful. And sometimes we help the terrorists. We give them credit when they don't deserve credit, and we fear things that we shouldn't fear. It's still, at the end of the day, you're more likely to be killed by your spouse, by, you know, falling off a ladder, whatever the list is, than you are to die in a terror attack.
And you point out that the number of terrorist incidents, at least as of 2015, which is a couple of years ago now, was down by about 15%.
And that most terror attacks occur in over 80% of all terror attacks occur in five countries, and none of which are the United States or Europe. It's mostly Muslim countries with Muslim victims that are facing the cost of terrorism. I'm not saying it isn't a challenge. It is a challenge. But we shouldn't deceive ourselves into thinking we can live in a world of 100% perfect security there are going to be risks, and sometimes you have to stand up and accept those, and don't help the terrorists by being more fearful than you should be.
And since 9/11, at least in this country, most of the terrorist attacks, have been lone wolf attacks. They may or may not have had very loose ties with some organization.
Yeah, we've actually had more terror attacks by right-wing elements in the United States, domestic elements, than we have had, that is to say, deaths, than we have had from so-called inspired Islamic terrorists. But the thing there is someone can go commit – some crazy person can commit a crime, and then as long as they say the word ISIS, and as long as the next day ISIS comes out and issues a press release saying, yeah, we'll take credit for that,
right,
then that just feeds on that fear.
And there probably are. Would you say there are events that have nothing to do with ISIS, and ISIS had nothing to do with, but they'll be happy to take credit for it?
Well, Mikey, we are seeing an unfortunate rash of what I would call copycat group shootings. Uh-huh. Newtown, just one. But all across the country, in an irrational way, somehow disappointed and disgruntled people have now gotten the idea that with access to weapons, they should go and shoot somebody. And it's school children in a lot of places. It's minors and youngsters.
Or people
it's
walking to airports.
Or people walking to airports. And we can catalog these, and they're horrible. And obviously, they produce a great deal of danger. We shouldn't subsume those automatically under the mantle of terrorism. Some of them have a terrorist objective, but they're not all. But we obviously need to find a way in our own country to try to improve our law and order processes here to deal with that kind of very difficult challenge that in one way or another has added to the mayhem and added to the insecurity and added to the uncertainty that people have with respect to terrorism at large around the world. And I see that kind of focus and that kind of concentration takes me back to the original recommendation I made a moment ago, that it's better intelligence, police watching, and it's better policing, hopefully friendly policing, if I could put it this way, that can help us increase our own sense of security and our own sense of well-being, and that for our children and grandchildren.
So what I'm hearing you say is this is not a foreign policy problem necessarily, but are there elements?
Of course, there are elements of foreign policy
that
in this.
That and result in
I don't
these
want in any way to minimize that, but relatively few, as Jim has said, Americans have gotten caught up in this. Mm-hmm. And Jim, tell us the five countries, because I think it's important for you to put that out.
Five countries where terrorism most
often.
Yeah,
let's see if I can remember them. It was Iraq. It was Syria, yeah. Obviously. I wrote this so long ago.
Libya, maybe?
I don't know. But they were all Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, of course.
All Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or yes,
right. Central, or East
Asia. But, far from the continental United States. They're the places where there are governments have collapsed, where there's, civil discord and where there are weak governments that allow these organizations free roam.
So if it's going to take better policing on our part domestically to tamp down these lone wolf attacks, it would stand to reason it will take better intelligence,
yes,
internationally to be aware of things that are creeping up and on the just over the horizon. Is Mr. Trump locked in because of his previous statements about having a war on ISIS and his statements about not trusting necessarily the intelligence community? Is he locked in to not being able to be nimble enough to do these things?
Well, I don't think so. I think that in some ways, Mr. Trump's kind of one-liners, if I could put it that way, his Twitter feeds, leave him open to segue, to change, because they are so general, mm-hmm, that, in fact, he has the value and the beauty of moving toward implementation with some of the kind of people he's appointed, particularly in the national security area, General Mattis, General Kelly, new Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson, into directions that can fulfill and carry out his general mandate, not necessarily the way he might have prescribed in his somewhat emotional language, but in a way that can be effective and realistic. I don't know where that will come or how it could come, but I'm telling you that there is enough of an opening to do those things that I would encourage him to move in that kind of direction and use the people who are well-versed, despite his claims of preeminent knowledge about the generals, to move these particular questions forward, using some of the tried and true methods, but perhaps putting some more emphasis on some of those methods and trying to find new ways to deal, particularly in foreign countries where the danger somehow originates and comes to us. But I would be very careful in declaring war on something, a concept in particular. And I'd be very careful in moving to a pattern where the American people somehow believe that it's a war on Islam or that it's a war on Muslims. This would be a huge and very serious mistake. There are 1.3 billion Muslims around the world, and I know many of them. I've had the fortunate experience of having served in a number of countries which are Muslim or countries in which there are large Muslim populations. And the run-of-the-mill, ordinary everyday person is like the run-of-the-mill, ordinary everyday American with the language differences and some of the cultural difference. There is nothing that I see here that predominates in Islam that leads to violence, that leads to segregation, that leads to annihilation in any way at all. It is a few people, and we have radical Christians and we have radical Jews in the world that lead in that direction, and it should not be an opportunity to somehow or other include all Muslims in this particular category of activity. We need Muslims to help us to deal with the aberration.
Let me jump in here. I share Tom's view that the president-elect has had a certain flexibility in the expression of his views, maybe taking one position here and a different position there on the same topic, and so that anything he may have said before isn't necessarily the end of the day. I will say I am deeply troubled about the statements that have been made. I've been a critic of the intelligence community. I've called for the resignation of senior officials at various points. But I would have to agree with Director Clapper when he says skepticism is healthy, but disparagement, you know, when you compare the intelligence community to living under Nazi Germany, when you insult them by saying, why should we listen to these guys? They got Iraq wrong, which, by the way, is not the real story of Iraq, parenthetically. I think that's troubling, and I don't think that makes for a good relationship. When you skip your daily briefings, you have one a week or two a week.
Right.
You're not really making full use of the U.S. government in the pursuit of its national security. That stuff does worry me.
Because it was said so frequently.
Mike, could I just say here, let me say that I agree with Jim on all of this. I wasn't in attempting to, in a Pollyannish kind of way, justify all of the, put it this way, unusual things that Mr. Trump has been saying. I was only saying that he appears to have, put it this way, some element of flexibility in his thinking that hopefully could be a point of useful value for us and the country in the future. I'm deeply concerned about the future of the country and deeply concerned about a man that I've watched who has not seen it yet possible to turn from a kind of virtual television or reality television posture to running the country, to governance. And governance is a very hard task.
Are there backstops against that? If he finds himself in office,
well,
unable
I think there,
to stop
there
tweeting.
Are, but let's not talk about that because he needs to have, put it this way, in the words of a standard rental contract, quiet enjoyment of the office for a while because it's important he needs to be given a chance to tell us all and show us how he can govern. That's the basis in which you should judge a man, not necessarily, although I'm worried about it, the kind of statements he has made going into the process. And so let's wait and see where that takes us.
And where that will take us is largely going to be a product of who ends up in the apparatus, the security apparatus, and also the Secretary of State area, the whole State Department. And when we come back, I want to get your views, both of your views, on some of the people that he has nominated for those positions, including Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and doctors making house calls, over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Mecklenburg County Solid Waste, through curbside recycling of plastics and paper, the community saves energy and money. Together, we can wipe out waste. Wipeoutwaste.com. Well, coming up, President-elect Trump's nominee for Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, faced tough questions in her Senate confirmation hearing on Tuesday. She's an advocate, of course, for school vouchers and for charter schools. And guest host Jane Clayson and her guest will talk about DeVos and what her appointment could mean for the future of public education. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point right here. And we'll continue our conversation about foreign policy in just a moment. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
It's a sight not seen for a generation. This morning, elements of an American armored brigade are rolling from Germany into Poland.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The North Tryon Vision Plan includes a bundle of potential improvements that leaders say could take at least two decades to fully implement.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're having a discussion about foreign policy and some of the challenges and opportunities that may face an incoming Donald Trump administration when it takes office on Friday. And we're having that conversation with Dr. Jim Walsh, Senior Research Associate with MIT's Security Studies Program and a security contributor for Here and Now on NPR, and Ambassador Thomas Pickering, seven-time ambassador, career ambassador. Let me give some of the bona fides here, because we're going to be talking about some of Donald Trump's nominees for various positions. You served, sir, as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Ambassador to the Russian Federation, to India, to Israel, to El Salvador, Nigeria, and Jordan. You were an ambassador to the United Nations, where you led the effort to build a coalition in the UN Security Council during and after the first Gulf War. And you've also held positions in other areas. And you speak fluently, I'm told, French, Spanish, Swahili, Arabic, Hebrew, and Russian.
A little less fluently the last three, Mike,
okay.
In all humility.
Nonetheless, a lot. So let's talk about, both of you know a lot about the world and a lot about how this country operates in the world and about how our diplomatic corps and our security machinery works. Rex Tillerson is the nominee to become the next Secretary of State. What are your thoughts on that?
Maybe I could start on that. I think his hearings went well. I think he perhaps pushed away too often a question on the basis that he wasn't up to speed. Mm-hmm. When Marco Rubio raised with him, "Why aren't you up to speed? You must read the New York Times," not something that Mark Rubio has necessarily championed in his political career because of the political orientation. But putting that aside, here's a man who's run a very large organization, an engineer, and I've worked with engineers because I work for the Boeing company, very smart people and very capable and very fact-driven, data-driven people. Mm-hmm. And this is very helpful because it appears as if the president does disdain data and is not so interested in facts unless, in fact, the facts are confected to meet his point of view. And so Mr. Tillerson will have the unenviable job of being the chief foreign policy advisor to the president, and hopefully will be having the kind of delegated responsibility that someone like President Reagan made it a particular attribute of his administration to do. And I think it served President Reagan very well. I have met and talked with General Mattis. I have great respect for him. He's a man who's done an enormous amount of reading and an enormous amount of study and research. He knows his field very, very well. I admired what he did in his confirmation hearings. He told it like it was. He did not pull any punches. I don't know General Kelly personally, but I know him by reputation, and he stands high in his reputation. Those three, I think, will carry the burden of the national security activities.
What about Michael Flynn?
I have seen Michael Flynn in action and had a great deal of respect for him when many, many years ago in Kabul in Afghanistan, he briefed us along with General Petraeus. And I thought he was remarkably smart. From then on, however, we have questions about that. And I don't want to judge a man until he's in office and in action. But there are questions about General Flynn that obviously he himself will have to answer, and we'll have to wait for that.
You were ambassador to the United Nations. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has been nominated to be the next ambassador to the United Nations, and she has no, admittedly, self-admittedly, has no foreign policy experience. And there's an article in the Charlotte Observer this morning, I think it's the Observer, it could be the New York Times, about one particular Democratic, so there's politics involved here, one particular Democratic member of the committee that will interview her, had an interview with her, and was disturbed that she could not answer a key question. And he pointed out that the ambassador to the United Nations is essentially going into the wolf's den with people who are career diplomats and who know a lot about everything, and she doesn't seem to know a lot about everything. Are you concerned about that?
I am. I think there are two things that we should look at with Governor Haley. One is there is a great deal in the United Nations that resembles the politics of a state. She must deal with a legislature, the General Assembly, and a kind of Senate, the Security Council. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, as governor, she has learned how to do that, how to relate to people, how to establish personal relationships. Secondly, the really interesting question, can she absorb knowledge? Every governor has to daily absorb knowledge. But it is very important that she appoint, she has four ambassadorial deputies in that job. She should appoint career people with deep knowledge. It's extremely important for her because she needs to have a small cabinet that she can feed off to begin to get on top of the subject. And there's nothing like somebody deeply experienced mm-hmm. to help you move through those particular kinds of questions you have to deal with. And she can have those along as she meets with foreign individuals to help her understand what it is the U.S. interest and how to carry it out. I know a number of the people that she'll be talking with, particularly my old friend Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador. He's a remarkably capable man and brilliant English. He was a spokesman for the Russian embassy in Washington years ago. And so she will be challenged. But with the kind of help that she can get, and she should reach out for that. That's my firm advice. And not let the White House people tell her she has to hire this bundler or that wonderful, deserving person. She should go for the really experienced career people to help her move through. And she's got a good staff there in New York. She would be wise to keep some of it so that she knows about the continuity that she's going to have to deal with.
We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to get out of the Middle East and get out of the Trump appointees and into some other areas that Mr. Trump and his cabinet and his whole organization will have to deal with. Let's talk about his approach to Russia and specifically to Vladimir Putin. It seems strange to most people and out of the ordinary. Is it because he is a businessman that he talks this way and a neophyte in international policy, or is it something else at work here, or do we know?
Well, it's not my job to read the inner feelings or mind of the president-elect, so I would be loath to speculate on that. I think there is an important point that Mr. Trump makes about U.S.-Russian relations that is definitely worth considering. Listen, the world is a tough place. We have the biggest economy in the world and the biggest military in the history of the world, and still there are problems all over the world that are difficult to solve. And sometimes you can solve them, but it means that the great powers have to cooperate to solve them. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, for whether it was the Iran deal, for example, when Russia and the U.S. cooperate and work from the same page, we can get some things done. And that makes the world a safer and better place. So we should try to take every opportunity to work with them where we can. I am concerned. Well, let's just put it out on the table. I was deeply concerned by several things said during the campaign. I was concerned that Mr. Trump at one press conference seemed to call on Russia to conduct cyber attacks against
which they did.
A candidate.
You know,
yeah.
So that I found very, very disturbing. I find we're in an odd situation right now where there are concerns expressed about Russia, and the president-elect says cites Putin as his defense. I think that's a little weird, you know, for anyone who grew up during the Cold War.
Well, he said, if Putin likes me, how could that be bad?
Mike, let me just add to what Jim said, because I agree with him. I spent 3.5 years in Russia. I've had an opportunity to meet with Mr. Putin years ago on several occasions and seen him in action. I think that it is important here to understand that Mr. Putin is in many ways potentially a very dangerous actor, that he needs to be met with a combination of firmness but also a set of doors that we're prepared to open for a solution that's in our interest. That's deal making. Trump's admiration for Mr. Putin, I think, may be misplaced, but it is at least part of an effort to take us out of the doldrums of the Russian relationship because, look, Russia has a nuclear capacity that, like ours, can destroy the planet. Mm-hmm. And accidents, miscalculations, misjudgment, misadventures can all end up in a very difficult situation for the two of us. And we found in the Cuban Missile Crisis that both sides came out with a much more mature view of how we should behave. And Mr. Putin's and Mr. Trump's throwing around why not use nuclear weapons if they have them is a sense of deep concern to me that if that really represents their point of view, they don't get it. And they don't get it because our mutual capacity to destroy the world, and once we start exchanging nuclear weapons or using them, I don't know any expert who has told me there is a guaranteed way to stop it, is a very dangerous circumstance. And we need to be very careful about that.
Is
an opportunity and a challenge here.
Is Mr. Putin meeting bluster with bluster? Could it be that Donald Trump doesn't understand what it means?
Well,
Mr. Putin, as a former head of the KGB, certainly understands.
Absolutely. Well, he certainly is engaged in bluster. But I would say, going back to your original question, is it when Mr. Trump asks, is it an asset that he likes me or that we get along?
Yeah, what could go
wrong? I would say, oh, boy. I would say yes. I mean, Tom's right that personal relationships matter in high politics and in low politics, in families and in governments. It does matter. But at the end of the day, it's national interests that drives foreign policy and governments. And you can like someone a lot, but if your national interests clash, that's going to define the
situation. But presidents have to open up opportunities often with a set of personal relationships to see how mutual national interests can be served.
Well, since Barack Obama's relationship with Vladimir Putin was not exactly what you would call warm and fuzzy, if Donald Trump takes that approach, could that actually be a good thing?
We don't know, but put it this way, it's not a bad thing initially to be able to have a relationship with a foreign leader who has dangerous propensities, but also with which we share common objectives. Neither of us wants to destroy the world and us with it. That's a very important starting place.
Well, you use the term common objective, and one thing that seems to be emerging as a potentially common objective is NATO. Putin is not a fan, and Trump has called NATO obsolete.
And I think that's a very dangerous problem for Mr. Trump to undertake to denigrate.
And is that playing into Putin's hands?
And his attacks on Mrs. Merkel over the last 2 days have been, in my view, totally against American interest and totally and against the interest of a right deal. Standing with Europe and with NATO is the bulwark that can help us deal with Mr. Putin in creative, constructive ways. And without it, why would you abandon your leverage, your allies, and your friends in a problem of this sort, even if, in fact, some of them are slow to fund their defense establishment the way we would like to see it?
If we're the largest economy in the world, I think the second largest is China. Is that right? Trump has said that we cannot allow China to rape our country. He was talking about what he refers to as bad trade deals, and because he sees China as a currency manipulator, and he's pledged to impose tariffs of up to 45% on Chinese imports to help resuscitate America's manufacturing sector. Is China raping our country through bad trade deals and or currency manipulation? And if so, is a 45% tariff a good idea?
You know, I think that's a road to a trade war, and you don't have to be a deep student of history to know that trade wars lead to depressions and depressions lead to world wars. So I think that's very dangerous waters to be treading. It has China manipulated its currency in the past? Yes. But to blame all our economic challenges on trade deals, I think, is a simplification. You know, there's all sorts of things going on in a complex global economy, not to mention automation and changes in technology that are all part of this. I guess what I would like to see is sort of you've got a very super friendly attitude towards Russia and a very harsh attitude towards China. Maybe if we could average those two, because in both cases we have countries – we're talking about countries that are great powers where we need to cooperate. We need to cooperate with China on North Korea. But we also need to realize that we're going to compete and need to compete fiercely with them where our interests clash.
And China is trying to have hegemony over most of Asia. We in this country have the Monroe Doctrine where we say this is our hemisphere, stay out. And we have enforced it. How can we prevent them from exercising the same control?
Hegemony is a different question. I think China wants to use Asia as a principal market. Uh-huh. But China has grown because the U.S. market has been available, and we have grown because China has taken on the opportunity of funding our debt. We are interlocked here in a way that is increasingly important for us to depend upon. So I don't see China marching troops into Vietnam. They tried it once and got their head handed to them by the Vietnamese. I do see China wanting to have a kind of economic relationship in Asia where there is mutual dependence, and we need trade deals with Asia to be able to supplant and supplement that kind of Chinese effort toward economic hegemony. Finally, trade wars kill jobs. They kill exports in the United States. And we are very heavily dependent on exports for good jobs. And exports provide good, innovative jobs because we're in competition. Protection provides stale, dying jobs because we're keeping alive places where we can't compete. And that's important. And our country needs better job retraining than we have to get those people who are losing jobs because of trade.
I have 15 seconds.
Yep.
Biggest threat that we face today.
Well, I worry about our own miscalculations, the damage we might do to ourselves by overreacting to things. Mr. Trump says he's a counterpuncher. I hope he shows some prudence.
That's Dr. Jim Walsh, Senior Research Associate at MIT Security Studies Program, security contributor to Here and Now, also with us, Ambassador Thomas Pickering, 7-time ambassador, career ambassador, member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you both for a wonderful hour.
Thank you, Mike.